Welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Academy, brought to you by the Plan B Network and Bitbox. This is chapter 5, I believe, of Bitcoin Sovereignty Through Mathematics, my first book on Bitcoin. I'm Knut Svanholm, and I'm here, as always, with Luke the Wolf. How are we today, Luke?
Oh, we are fantastic, Knut. Thank you for asking. Good morning, and I'm excited to be here. How are you?
All good. It's a lovely morning here. No, it's not a lovely morning. It's a shitty morning, but it's lovely anyway because we're doing this.
Absolutely agree with that. Yeah, it's a bit cloudy outside for me also. All right. Shall we first just remind all of our listeners how you can get involved? You can go to our Geyser page, geyser.fund/project/infinity, for all the information about how you can join the Academy and get involved. And as a reminder, we're also releasing all of the chapters for free on Nostr. So the links will be in all of the descriptions for this and you can read along there. Am I forgetting anything, Knut?
I don't think so. So we can just jump into this chapter called Proof of Work here and see what's in this one.
Absolutely wonderful. All right, let's do it. Proof of Work. Zoom out of time for a while and imagine how the antlers of a magnificent moose buck evolved into being. The main purpose of big antlers in nature is believed to be a way for the buck to impress potential mates. They're somewhat akin to the feathers of a peacock, or the shroud of any male bird for that matter. The animal is trying to signal that it can thrive in its environment despite its enormous appendage. It's there to tell the potential mate that this specific specimen will bring her strong, healthy offspring. These are all evolutionary metaphors, of course. The animal itself is probably unaware of signaling anything. For such antlers to evolve into being, a whole lot of moose will have to die early, or at least not get a chance to reproduce, over thousands of generations. In other words, a lot of resources need to be wasted. All of this for the animal to prove its value to potential spouses. Therefore, from the surviving moose's point of view, the aforementioned resources were sacrificed rather than wasted. Good start. I see where this is going, and always love a moose metaphor.
Of course you do. You're a Canuck. So isn't it an elk metaphor? No, it's a moose in Canada, right? And an elk. So where are
elks? There's both.
Okay.
It would be reindeer though if we were talking Scandinavian.
And is the plural of moose meese?
It's definitely meese, yes.
All right. And elk and many elk?
Elk and many elk. Yes, that's correct.
Good.
Actually,
yes.
Eskimos is the correct plural of elk.
I believe that's Inuit. Isn't it?
That's politically correct, Knut.
Okay then. All right. We'll have some editing to do already here, I think.
I think we can leave most of that in.
Yeah, all right then. Anyway, this is one example of many in nature of proof of work, especially in birds. If I'm not mistaken, I mean, I'm not a biologist by any stretch of the imagination. But from what I know of evolutionary theory, this is one of the things that was hardest to explain, like traits in animals and plants that didn't have an obvious survival mechanism thing attached to them. But they figured out later that it's used for actually proof of work. So the feathers of a peacock, for instance, or strange mating rituals in birds, they are actually there for the animal to signal to the other animal that they are capable of more than meets the eye. And this is a very good metaphor for what proof of work is in Bitcoin, I believe. Like, you could, from a certain perspective, you could say that it's actually proof of results rather than proof of work, because it's only the actual valid block that counts. So it's more alluding to work than proving work, because you could be super lucky with your bit axe or something and just find the correct block after having tried a handful of times. But usually, if the difficulty is high enough, it takes trillions of guesses per second for the network to find the correct block. So this is at the very core of what Bitcoin is. That maybe also. Like make this point that everything in Bitcoin is probabilistic. So the reason it takes 10 minutes to find the next block on average is that it's the probability is set in such a way that it takes on average 10 minutes. And every 2 weeks, it's recalibrated with the difficulty adjustment algorithm. So the 10 minutes are dependent on these 2 weeks, and the 2 weeks are dependent on the 10 minutes. So it's a loop thingy going on there. And it's one of, like, I've never met a person that can accurately describe the difficulty adjustment algorithm and and simultaneously be against Bitcoin or have good arguments for why Bitcoin doesn't work. Because that's when it usually, when it actually clicks, is when you get the difficulty adjustment algorithm. So what else to say about that? I think that's it.
That's great. And I mean, this chapter is a great explanation of the proof of work mechanism. And so I think here, well, first of all, you've gone and dug into the actual Bitcoin parts. I think we'll cover it in the upcoming paragraph or paragraphs, but yeah, it's great. I mean, I think just first of all, on this evolutionary metaphor, it's ingenious. I hadn't ever thought of it quite this way myself, that would be akin to this whole proof of work thing, that evolution over time is akin to the proof of work versus proof of results thing. Like the result is that you get a better chance at reproducing something like that, and it takes a long time. It's not an exact perfect corollary, but it does have elements of what evolution actually is, because there's misconceptions about evolution. It's not necessarily exactly about this, you have a better chance of reproducing. It's also an aggregate. It's like you say, it's probabilistic. Something that maybe makes one individual moose, for example, capable of having an offspring might mean that they don't have enough food to go around for the pack of meese, and that little particular subclade of meese dies out. Right. So it's the things that actually work over time, not in single generations either, which I think is another point that's along the lines of what you were saying here.
Yeah. And I think the biggest, most common misconception about evolution in general is the time scale. Because these timescales are huge, they're enormous. They take like hundreds of thousands, even millions of years for things to come into being. And there is so much trial and error. So like, it's not survival of the fittest, it's survival of whoever survives for whatever reason they may survive. Like, and this is true on a cellular level as well as on a pack level. So there's a lot of things going on there, and it's widely misunderstood, but I think the proof of work metaphor works really well.
Exactly. And we just had a question in the chat about how is it possible for a BitAxe to find a block? And I mean, the answer is that it's an extremely low probability, right? It's extremely unlikely that a BitAxe would find a block, but it is possible technically.
No, exactly. We're back to that's a good question, by the way. And it's all about probabilistics. I mean, you could do the hash by hand and find the correct block if you were really, really, really amazingly lucky. But the probability is so low, so it's not worth the effort. And that's at the core of what Bitcoin is. Like the only reason you say that you own the Bitcoin is that you find it very improbable that someone else holds the same private key, but it's not actual ownership. It's just knowing a number.
Yep, exactly. Nothing else to add here. Maybe let's get into the specifics that you wrote about previously. All right, on to the next one. The proof of work algorithm in Bitcoin does a similar thing. It enables miners to sacrifice a lot of electricity, a real-world resource, to find a certain number, thereby proving that they had to commit a lot of time and effort to do this. Time, by the way, is the scarcest of all resources. Because of all this, a Bitcoin miner is very reluctant to sell Bitcoin at a net loss. The electricity has already been used when the Bitcoin pops into existence, and the miner has no other means of getting his money back than by selling the Bitcoin for more than the cost of the electricity it took to produce them. This is assuming that the mining rig itself has already been paid for. Proof of work is a way of converting computing power into money, in a sense. Yes, these rigs consume a lot of energy, but the energy consumed correlates directly to the actual value of the created token. Any decrease in the energy expenditure would also lead to a decrease in the value of the token. Not necessarily in the price, but the actual value. This is the main reason mining algorithms can't be less resource consuming or more energy efficient. Wasting energy is the whole point. No waste, no proof of commitment. Interesting. What are your thoughts here, Knut?
Yeah. If you found yourself in a dark cave and you had a flashlight and you found a gold bar and you found a piece of paper with a bunch of zeros followed by strange letters, like, what would intrigue you the most? So this might sound like a strange question. What I'm alluding to is that anyone who understands how extremely hard it is to find the hash of a Bitcoin block and a hash beginning with that many zeros can instantly see how much energy must have been sacrificed to find the block. So that thing in itself is like, should trigger the question in your mind, why on earth was this person willing to sacrifice so much effort to find this number? It's weird, isn't it? And that should trigger all the other questions and intrigue you enough to figure out what Bitcoin is and come to the holy shit, this is super valuable conclusion. But there's a lot here. Some of the terms I wouldn't have used maybe if I wrote this now with the value and the price in the end here. I think there's a lot of bad metaphors around for Bitcoin's scarcity or finiteness on how to like convert electricity into, you know, digital energy and all of this stuff. I don't really like those terms because that's not actually what it is. All it is like one specific part of a finite pie. That finite pie, it's valuable because people think it's valuable. Like everything else, it's value is subjective. So the value part is iffy, but I'd say what it can do is convert energy into a very specific part of a very specific pie.
You know, I think the metaphors are still helpful. We've been over this a little bit, that it's still often helpful for newer Bitcoiners or pre-coiners even to understand what's going on. But yeah, it's not literally, for example, a battery, or not literally energy being converted into money, but it is a way for energy that would otherwise not be used to be consumed in a productive way. And in that sense, it's as close to a battery or energy being converted into money as possible. The uses for this are bountiful now.
I'd say energy being converted into money is a correct metaphor.
Okay.
But calling it digital energy is not. I tweeted a thing yesterday along these lines, by the way, which is how I'm thinking about this nowadays. And that is, when orange peeling, avoid metaphors that attract midwits but repel edges of the bell curve people. So that's my advice, because it's more important to get the edges of the bell curve people into Bitcoin than it is to get the middle of the bell curve people into Bitcoin, in my opinion. Because what you want is the rednecks with pickup trucks and don't tread on me shotguns. And you want the really, really clever people. And everyone else will follow eventually if you just get those. So like, this is what to think about when figuring out metaphors for the different functions of the Bitcoin network, in my opinion.
Very good point. And well, I think there are some people who are making the arguments for the midwits and are just trying to get as many people into Bitcoin as possible. But I think we need both approaches, basically.
Yeah. But I prefer the other approach. Like, the midwits will eventually come anyway. And that's good to remember.
Point. Okay, let's move on to the next one here.
Yeah, sorry if anyone got from, I don't really mean midwit. I mean middle of the bell curve person. That's much less offensive.
Somehow. Yeah. All right, on to the next one. The fundamental principles of Bitcoin were set in stone in 2008, and block number zero, the so-called Genesis block, was mined in January 2009. In Bitcoin, a block of transactions is created every 10 minutes. In its first 4 years of existence, these blocks included a 50 Bitcoin block reward given to the miner who found the block. Every 4 years, this reward is halved so that the maximum amount of Bitcoin that can ever be claimed can never exceed just short of 21 million. Every 2016th block, or roughly every 2 weeks, the difficulty of finding a new block is recalibrated so that a block will be found every 10 minutes on average. The value of this feature and the impact it has on coin issuance is often understated. It is one of the features of Bitcoin that separates it from gold and other assets in one of the most subtle yet most powerful ways. When the price of gold or silver or oil or any other asset goes up, producing that asset becomes more profitable, and more resources are allocated to produce more of it faster. This, in turn, evens out the price as the total supply of said asset increases. Gold has been able to maintain or increase its value long-term over time because of its high stock-to-flow ratio. Stock refers to the supply of an asset currently available on the market. Flow refers to the amount added to the stock per time unit. The bigger the stock in relation to the flow, the less of an impact on the total supply an increase in the price of a specific asset has. In Bitcoin, a price increase has virtually no impact at all on the coin issuance rate, the flow, since the difficulty of finding the next block in the chain is constantly being optimized for a strict issuance schedule. No other asset has ever behaved like this, and we are yet to find out what impact its existence will have on the world economy. Yeah, so a bunch of the specifics about how the proof of work algorithm and difficulty adjustment works.
Yes, this is the term stock to flow is something you should know about if you're in Bitcoin, and because it's very important to understand the value proposition here. And this is also pointing out why Bitcoin is not digital gold and why it's so much better than gold, because it has a finite supply. Gold does not. The reason that a cow priced in gold is costs about the same now as 5,000 years ago is that the ability for humans to find new gold increased in parallel with the increase of productivity of everything else, meaning that gold's stock to flow is diminishing, but not at the same rate as Bitcoin, because we will eventually run out of Bitcoins. We won't eventually run out of gold. So it's super different there. And therefore, also to everyone aware of this issuance schedule, you could say that all the Bitcoins already exist and that they've always existed even. And that it's just that the hash rate was zero up until 2009 and when this thing materialized. And this is so fascinating to me. Like the way I see it, the miners do not produce the Bitcoins. They produce blocks, and we, the network, pay them in Bitcoins to secure the network for us and produce blocks, which we can fill with transactions. The way they get paid is through the block subsidy, which is block reward plus fees. And the block reward part of it, the thing that halves every 4 years, is how many Bitcoins we allow them to print out of thin air for themselves per every 10 minutes. But it's set in stone already, and there won't ever be more than 21 million Bitcoins, which is why everything divided by 21 million makes sense from some angles. So if you know about this, you've already priced that in, and you know that this is the most precious thing you can ever own.
Yeah, I think we've already somewhat talked about these specific features. I think the contrast to gold is one of the interesting things here. The more interesting things to grasp, basically. The line, no other asset has ever behaved like this, and we're yet to find out what the impact its existence will have on the world economy. Yeah, that's basically it. What's happening, what we're seeing as miners pretty much constantly pour more resources into Bitcoin mining. We're at, I think we changed to having a, it's an exahash now. Like there was something about that we're on another zero in hashes.
Yeah.
Recently.
And or another three zeros. So it's another prefix.
Well, yeah, right. It's another prefix. And it didn't just like barely hit the exahash number. It like burst through it even. Despite that the more production doesn't actually lead to an increase in the production of the good, more miners or more individuals are choosing to start up miners and attempt to find the Bitcoin, basically. And I think that's the natural effect here, that it's a totally scarce resource. Therefore, if you get some of it, you have a fixed amount of the fixed supply. That's it. And yeah. That's never going to change. That's never going to be inflated away, at least while those of us who understand Bitcoin have anything to say about it.
Yeah, maybe make a point here about probabilistics again. Like the probability that it ever will change, it's so low that we can treat it as if it will never change. But it could theoretically change if everyone in the the network agrees that that's a good decision. So that's the beauty of this thing. Like it's robust because it's what's the word? Anti-fragile. Because we all have to agree that it needs to change in order for it to change. So it's not like a democracy at all. It's you need an absolute supermajority. And another way to look at that is that you need it to be a good idea for the good idea to be implemented. Because everyone agrees it's a good idea, then it is a good idea. Objectively, everyone thinks so. So yeah, there's that about that. Maybe I should say a couple of more things about the stock to flow thing. So because it's only skimmed on the surface here. So the thing that happens when gold's price goes up is that gold miners buy more spades. They buy mining equipment in spades so that they can find more gold per time unit. But at the same time, the total gold supply of gold in the Earth's crust is running out. So it becomes like the bigger the stock of gold that is already there, the less of an impact this change in price has to the flow of new gold coming into the market because they allocate more resources to finding it. And here Bitcoin's completely different. The supply is not dependent on how much you try to find them. That's it. You don't get more than one block for every 10 minutes. Like that's how it works. And it's beautiful. So you're not getting more Bitcoins, but you're getting more value for your hashing power. And that's sort of the point.
Very good point it is. And I think the details about this just continue on here now in the following paragraph. So I think let's continue. So how does one mine a block in the Bitcoin blockchain? In short, the mining process goes something like this. Every active node in the Bitcoin network stores a copy of the mempool, which contains all Bitcoin transactions that haven't been confirmed yet. The miner puts as many transactions as the block size allows into the block, usually selecting those with the highest fee first. He then adds a random number, called a nonce, and produces a hash of the entire thing using the SHA-256 hashing algorithm. A hashing algorithm turns data into a string of numbers. If the resulting hash begins with a specific number of zeros decided by the current difficulty of the network, the miner wins the block reward, collects all the fees, and gets to put the block on the blockchain. I think I could continue here, but honestly, there's a couple of points to discuss just directly from this paragraph, I think.
Yes, here, the thing I'd like to point out is that there's no such thing as the mempool. Every node decides what their mempool consists of. You don't have to put transactions in your mempool if you don't like the transactions. Like we come to a consensus of what constitutes a valid transaction, and that's what happens. That's what decides what transactions you put in your mempool. Of course, if you don't allow, or if you censor, and if your mempool is very much different from everyone else's, the chances of them actually being okayed by all the other participants in a block is lower. But yeah, maybe I'm not explaining that really well here. But point is that there is no such thing as the mempool. There are plenty of different mempools.
Yes, and of course that's an important distinction here. The collective mempool, such as it is, as in the average mempool based on those transactions which are mostly circulating. Okay, that's sort of a fine concept that does exist. Again, we're in the territory of things that are really useful to know if you really want to understand everything as it is down to the base of it, but not necessarily. You can think of the abstraction a little bit in the general sense. Like I'm broadcasting my transaction to the mempool. I think that's fine to think that, but yeah, you're right. It's you're broadcasting a transaction to from your node or from someone else's node to a bunch of other nodes, and they keep broadcasting it, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how it actually ends up. And they can be different because you can set different policies or choose to have only transactions. You can choose not to broadcast transactions, but put them in your mempool. And if you're a miner, that's how you could mine transactions that are out of band and not broadcast it to the whole rest of the network.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into this. Without getting too technical, Bitcoin is dependent on users being active and running their nodes and actually taking care about like what their node does and what kind of transactions it lets through or not. And it's people doing that. That's what becomes the average after a while, right? That's what eventually all of it is about, coming to an agreement. That's what we call consensus.
Yes, consensus. That's a important word. And as you say, maybe this isn't the time to go too technical or too deep into some of these features. I think we'll dig more deeply into concepts of the types of transactions that are permitted and other mechanisms like that. But I think maybe it's perhaps for another time, or what do you think? Do you want to get into the whole filtering?
Yeah, no, we get into the weeds of this in the Clown World book, and we'll see what has happened then. And it's interesting because we're not starting that whole series. Like we're starting that like a year from now or something. So it's going to be very interesting to see how well that aged, I guess. And by the way, consensus is spelt with a C and not a K.
Absolutely. All right, let's move on. The beauty of the system is that it is trivial for the nodes in the network to verify the block so that no double spending can occur. But it's near impossible to forge a fake hash, since the probability of finding one that begins with as many zeros as the difficulty of the Bitcoin network demands is extremely low. To a layman's eye, a hash beginning with a bunch of zeros just looks like a random number, but a person who understands the mathematics behind it sees a different thing. The zeros act as proof of an enormous commitment to trying out different nonces and trying to find a perfect match. If you're able to understand these huge numbers, you quickly realize that this number must have been created by devoting computing power to doing just that on an absolutely massive scale. The proof is in those zeros. If you compare just the hash rate of the top five so-called cryptocurrencies, it is obvious that Bitcoin is on a different level security-wise. From a hash rate to security perspective, the Ethereum blockchain is about 5 times as ineffective, and the Litecoin blockchain about 10 times as ineffective as the Bitcoin blockchain at the time of writing. This in addition to the obviously more centralized nature of these alternatives. Yeah, I think I'll pause there. I'm not sure exactly how much we haven't covered out of these. Of course, the little bit about the shitcoins is in addition, but I don't know how long you want to linger on that.
No, but it's an important paragraph, and maybe I jump to conclusions too early here in this chapter because it's explained here. But it's crucial to understand why a number beginning with zeros is hinting at something very valuable. But the interesting thing about the what I say about the so-called cryptocurrencies or shitcoins in the end here is that this was written in 2019, early 2019. I believe it must have been in February or something. So, and since then, this has just been more and more true. Like today, it's not even comparable anymore. Like Ethereum is such a shit show at this point, and Litecoin too. Like there's not even a comparison to be made.
And Ethereum isn't even using proof of work anymore.
No. So it has absolutely no security. Like proof of stake is provably not working. It is the system we're living in. Like central banking is proof of stake. So one guy gets to decide. Like it is by definition centralized. If you have more resources, you win. Like Bitcoin is only decentralized because it needs to be. Like decentralization is an unfortunate means to a greater end, and that end is an absolutely finite supply of the monetary token or resistance to replicability, something you cannot copy. That is the end goal. The decentralization, it's unfortunate that it's needed, because we only need it because people cannot be trusted. If every human being was trustworthy, we wouldn't need Bitcoin. We could just decide that these are the number of coins available and it wouldn't be inflated. The reason we need the decentralization is to secure the network so that everyone keeps everyone else in check, so that it's not profitable anymore to try to break the rules. That's the sad truth about this thing. But it's also what makes it so beautiful, because in the end, that don't trust, verify mentality leads to a society that is more trusting. Like we humans unlock something within ourselves when we become Bitcoiners, and it becomes easier to trust your fellow man, not harder, because you know that fellow man has no incentive to cheat you anymore. So yeah, it's such a beautiful system, and that's why I started writing about it. It's just mind blown by the whole thing and what it implies.
Yeah, just great. And honestly, these points about why the other so-called cryptocurrencies just don't fit the bill, it's important to discuss this stuff. Absolutely. Because otherwise, people trying to get into Bitcoin, trying to figure it out, get led astray constantly and think that some of these things are legitimate. And I have a lot of empathy for people who have had their shitcoin phase or who get into crypto, because many of them are not there for the gambling. They think it's the way out of a system that is broken, and just think crypto is the thing. It's the thing that's going to go up, and whatever it is, it's all ignorance. It's all from not getting directed to the right thing, which of course is Bitcoin. And so this is why I like explaining this stuff, because it actually is relevant.
Yeah.
If you're here with us, you probably already have this figured out, but still it bears repeating.
I mean, still there, Bitcoiners shouldn't like try to forbid shitcoins or forbid Bitcoin forks. That's very counterproductive. Bitcoin is what it is because we agree that it is this thing. But that also implies that we need alternatives to exist to figure out what the real thing is. But at the end of the day, it's very, very simple. Fiat currencies, one guy gets to decide if we're going to print more money or not. So one guy can print money, or one institution can print money. Shitcoins or cryptocurrencies, everyone gets to print more money. So it's up to you. Bitcoin, no one gets to print money. That's the difference between the three.
Very good point. I think that's a good summary there. On to the next one. Some of the futurists and doomsday prophets mentioned in chapter 4 as the people most likely to warn us about the dangers of the impending artificial intelligence singularity believe that we already live in a simulated reality. The main argument for this worldview is that since simulations and computer graphics seem to be getting better at an ever-accelerating rate, we can't really know if we already live in a simulation or not. To put it another way, we simply have no way of knowing if we live in the Matrix or if our perceived reality is all there is. A really mind-blowing counter-argument to this theory is that Bitcoin's proof-of-work algorithm would eventually slow down the simulation, since proof-of-work is verifiable and can't be simulated itself. Computing power would have to be sacrificed by some entity somewhere, regardless. One question remains, though. Can the inhabitants of a simulated reality actually feel or measure a slowdown of the very simulation they live in? Interesting thought experiment to end the chapter.
Yes, it has nothing to do with the rest of the chapter, does it? I discussed this with Dhruv Bansal and Giacomo Socco on stage at Bitcoin Atlantis, I believe, in Madeira. I love this thought. And this is one of those, it's just provoking thought in every way possible. And then I don't leave anything else. I don't explore the ideas with the reader. I just mention them. So I don't know why I did that in this book, really. But the thought still intrigues me. When thinking about this simulation theory thing, it's important to remember that simulation theory is not a new idea. It's been around for like 500 years, this matrixy dream within a dream within a dream concept. Philosophers have been battling that since forever. And it's sort of like the free will debate. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter because we're in the reality we are in and we're not in the other realities. Same thing with free will. If you have it, then there's no discussion. If you don't, you can't do anything about anything anyway. So you might as well act as if you do. It's one of those weird things. But it is interesting that a simulation of Earth would have to include a simulation of the proof of work in Bitcoin mining, which in itself is costly in terms of computing power. I just like that fact, if you want.
It is an interesting thought experiment, definitely. And well, so much as there are smart people who really think we are in fact in a simulation and all of the computing power being used for this and that. Yeah, it's hard to square these two things, I guess, that the probability that we're in a simulation to some people's estimation is extremely high. But there's all of this computing going on. And by the way, all the AI stuff also is in that category, honestly, because they're using computing power also. Maybe that's less verifiable because it's not about mathematical cryptography, but it's still a lot of computing power. Maybe the AI stuff is actually more of evidence for the simulation because maybe that stuff can be more easily faked. I don't know.
No, but that's where the theory comes from, that AI is getting so good and computer graphics are getting so good. Of course, these things are run on computers, so they would require a lot of computing power. This is just saying that the computer on top creating that reality with that thing in it would also have to do the proof of work algorithm, which is more computing power than anything else on Earth right now. It's still the biggest computer network there is the Bitcoin network. So no, it's an intriguing thought. Anyway, by the way, I looked up howmanyconfs.com and that site is still up. What did I say in the last paragraph there? That Litecoin had a fifth of the security of Bitcoin or something?
You said a tenth.
A tenth. Yeah, today it's the second biggest because Ethereum isn't even there anymore since they moved to proof of stake. And Litecoin is 11 times slower today. Six confirmations in Bitcoin is equivalent to 268 confirmations on Litecoin to get to the same level of security. And then there's Dogecoin and then there's Ethereum Classic. But yeah, the point stands that it's getting worse over time and not better for the shitcoins.
Yeah, very good point. And I think the summation of this chapter, since we're done now, is basically that proof of work is this fundamental thing at the base of Bitcoin. Proof of work algorithm plus the difficulty adjustment, and these things are essential. And explaining why they're essential, I think, is the point of this chapter. Do you have anything else you'd like to say in summation?
No, that's a good summation. And proof of work is very misunderstood. environmentalists who misunderstand it think that it's wasting energy, but that's the complete wrong way to look at it. It's not wasting energy, it's sacrificing energy for something much better. And what they also forget about is the consensus mechanism of fiat currencies. We've alluded to this before, because the consensus mechanism of fiat currencies and whoever gets to decide what money a nation runs on, or what gets to be the global reserve currency, is world wars. That's the consensus mechanism. And if that's not wasteful, I don't know what wasteful is. So they're not taking into account how costly in terms of energy the current monetary system is. This doing proof of work, I would argue, is actually the most efficient way of getting to a consensus of what is money and what is not. Every other way that has been tried has been more costly in terms of not only you need world wars to come to a consensus, but of the vast number of, first and foremost, the vast number of misallocated resources in society. It's like this example from previous chapters that you never get to exponential growth if you shoot yourself in the foot all the time and put up roadblocks to prosperity, which is what monetary interventionists do all the time, not only by taxing people, but by inflating the money supply. It gets harder for people to accumulate wealth and prosper and progress humanity into the future. Everything is handicapped by interventionism. And that is what that is the problem that Bitcoin solves. It solves the inflation problem. It solves the abundance of money and scarcity and everything else. So it's the other way around. This is Jeff Booth's point. Like, when you have scarcity in money, you have abundance everywhere else. And people need to understand that on a deep level to understand Bitcoin. Like, I don't believe you can understand Bitcoin if you don't first understand the problem it solves. And that problem is inflation.
Absolutely love it. Fantastic summation. So I think with that, this has been the proof of work chapter from Sovereignty Through Mathematics. And now I'll just say, hey, if you've enjoyed listening to this episode, watching or listening, like on YouTube or on Rumble, subscribe to the channel. It always helps. Leave a comment. That really, really helps. Both of the algorithms really like that. Leave a comment on Noster or on Twitter or something also when we post them there. Yeah, join the discussion. Let us know what you think about the episode. We really appreciate it. And of course, you can go to our Geyser page, geyser.fund/project/infinity, for full information about how you can join the Academy and get involved yourself.
Yes, and you can get all the books from bitcoininfinity.com, our store, where we have re-edited all the books and made these beautiful hardcovers. And if you buy anything off the store, you automatically get access to the base Telegram group for the Academy. So there's another reason to do that.
Absolutely. And I think we'll also round this off with a big thank you to Plan B Network for sponsoring this Academy initiative. We're thrilled to be partnering with them. They are a fantastic educational resource. PlanB.network, you can go there to check out all of the courses they have available that are everything from newbie-friendly stuff to more deep dives into various facets of Bitcoin, written by tons of different authors, and they're translating them into tons of different languages. And so this show is really a great fit for them, and we're thrilled to be working with them. We release a slightly condensed version of this show on their channel as well, which is just a little more directly on the educational side, slightly less tangents, but check out everything they're doing. And if you want to support them, you can also come to the Plan B Forum conferences in Lugano or El Salvador. And you also see us there generally, I think. So that's yet another reason to check out Plan B Network.
Yeah. And speaking of this year's BIS school has started, and also last year's BIS school, which is a full course about Bitcoin and how you can implement it in your business, is the last year's course is now open sourced and available for free from the Plan B website. So either take this year's course or enroll for that thing, or take listen to the lectures from last year's course. I highly recommend it. They have the best teacher in the world, in my opinion. Giacomo Socca is the head chef there. So he's always entertaining and interesting to listen to. So go ahead and do that.
Absolutely perfect addition there. Yes. And also thank you to Bitbox. They're our favorite hardware wallet, and they're a supporter of both our regular show and of the Academy. So thank you to them for that. And they don't compromise on security, but they are really user-friendly. So it's the hardware wallet that not only for you as a Bitcoiner, but your friends, your family, all the pre-coiners that we definitely recommend for that. So go check out bitbox.swiss/infinity and get the Bitbox Zero to Bitcoin Only edition for a discount, plus everything else on their store. Got some other cool stuff.
Yeah, and come to BTC Hell. The Bitcoin conference in Helsinki that we're co-organizing. It's going to be lots of fun. We have lots of great speakers. And yeah, looking forward to seeing you all there. Or at any of the other conferences. Like if you're going to a Bitcoin conference or if you're buying Bitcoin paraphernalia, you should try to use code Infinity everywhere, because we have that code with most of our friends. We have a lot of friends. So yes. That's a good way to get a discount.
Definitely. And you'll see us you'll see Knut in Ireland, both of us in Prague, both of us in Riga now, I think. And then of course, Helsinki. So
Calgary.
Calgary. Yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah. 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 We'll be in tons of places this summer. So come see us somewhere. But if you come see us anywhere and you're, you know, traveling or whatever it is, come to Helsinki. Yeah. Just do that. Yeah. We're really excited about it. We're just about to open a physical pop-up shop actually in Helsinki. So we're really excited about that. You'll be able to come see us there. You'll even be able to get finished translations of Knut's first two books pretty soon here. We're working on the third and fourth one. So, yeah, exciting things happening in Finland and Helsinki.
Yeah. Super cool.
And I think with that, thank you very much for listening. This has been the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. Anything else to add, Knut?
Spadoinkle, as usual. Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.